From the scratchy studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another ivy bashing hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. This has been a banner year for poison ivy, and a terrible one for those allergic to it. I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, we'll discuss the possibility that a lineman for Bell Telephone was protected from the rash by a mysterious liquid many decades ago. Plus your fabulous phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and positively ponderous pontifications. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up like you laughing at poison ivy because you took the cure.
WDIY has been broadcasting in the Lehigh Valley and beyond for 30 years, providing news.
These planes were hijacked.
The Bethlehem Steel Corporation will end its steelmaking production in Bethlehem.
We hope that you enjoyed hearing from the Dalai Lama.
Local public affairs.
As I say, it's a race of interest.
What we're experiencing today will later on be studied.
And music.
My name is Janice Ian.
Our guest, Lake Street Dive.
In a few minutes, we're going to be talking to Petey Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
WDIY, since 1995.
From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, where the turtles are once again happy together, it's time for another ecological hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, you bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we report on a story of invasive eradication by writer Greta Cross that recently appeared on the USA Today website. And we quote, "A constellation of eyes welcomed Sydney Woodruff the first time she went nighttime frog spotting at Yosemite National Park. Her headlamp lit up thousands of eyes that belonged to the invasive American bullfrog, peering up at her from where they lurked in the water." Interrupting McGrath here, you may be wondering how an American bullfrog can be invasive here in the States. Easy. The bullfrog is native to the eastern U.S. and Canada, but was transported far beyond its typical range during the gold rush, when they were imported for food, as they have the largest legs of any frog. Now, back to USA Today's story. Woodruff, a PhD candidate at University of California, Davis, is the lead author of a recently published study that analyzed how the removal of American bullfrogs affected the population of native northwestern pond turtles at Yosemite National Park. Over the course of 6 years, Woodruff and her team removed more than 16,000 bullfrogs from the park, an invasive species that makes life for the northwestern pond turtle nearly impossible. But now, with less frogs in the mix, the native turtle is reappearing. We focused on the impact to turtles, but we also see many other positive changes in the environment, Woodruff told USA Today. It's really exciting to see what these sites should look like. American bullfrogs are, quote, "a highly successful invasive species," explains Woodruff. "This is due to their size and particularly their stomachs. Bullfrogs can weigh 2 to 3 pounds and are known for eating a variety of prey, including insects, crustaceans, other amphibians, reptiles, fish, small birds, and mammals. Woodruff's study found that if it fits in their mouth, they'll eat it." During her research, Woodruff reported numerous instances of small pond turtles found inside American bullfrog stomachs, and the pond turtles that were still in the habitat were old and large, indicating that they only survive because they wouldn't fit in the frog's mouth. Woodruff's team studied and removed American bullfrogs in the areas between Yosemite's Lake Eleanor and Hetch Hetchy Reservoir, which are about 40 miles north of Yosemite Valley. Woodruff said there were three ways her team removed the bullfrogs: catching the frogs from shore, riding inflatable boats out to catch frogs further out in the water, and collecting egg masses from the water. In total, Woodruff and her team collected and removed 16,384 bullfrogs, larvae, and whole egg masses from Yosemite. The sites where Woodruff and her team removed the bullfrogs are now completely different, she said. Northwestern pond turtle hatchings and youth are swimming about. The native California red-legged frog has reappeared, and several other native species are back, ones that would have previously been eaten by those bad bullfrogs.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to acknowledge a fabulous little message we got from a guy named Jack Keefe. Mike, I love the show every week. Many years ago, my late wife, Leslie Keefe, who was production manager at Rodale, would have me listen to the show when it aired out of WHYY in Philly. I learned a lot from her and now have four raised bed gardens at my house in Whitehall, PA. Continued success on the show. Well, thank you, Jack. These little notes are things we live for in this business. So thanks for taking the time to send them our way. (610) 694-8100 extension number 3. Frank, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for allowing me to speak with you.
Well, you are so welcome. What a nice way to say that, isn't it? Yeah, it is already a pleasure. What can we do you? Oh, wait a minute. Where are you?
Cherry Hill.
Cherry Hill, just across the Ben Franklin Bridge. Okay, I got you. All right, what can we do you for?
Well, I sent you an email about my garlic, which I had been having very nice crops for about 4, maybe 5 years.
Right.
I have 3 raised beds, and I do rotate them. I move the garlic every 3 years to a different bed. And I've had just bumper crops out of it. It's a 4x4 raised bed, and I've had crops for, you know, 4 years until this year. I did the same thing I always do. When I harvest the bulbs in, it's usually sometime in June, late June, they start falling over the greens. And I try to take the biggest ones and get the biggest pieces to hold, you know, to use for my starter for the next year. In October, I put in planted my garlic again, just like I've done every other year. And the greens came up, and mine usually get 12, 14 inches, maybe 16 inches tall before we get December.
Frank, that all depends on the weather. It's going to be different every year. Now, I can already give you an important tip. Do not wait till October. The Pocono Garlic Growers Association did some real good citizen science, and they found that planting in September gives the cloves more time to grow roots, get acclimated to the soil, and as a result, you get bigger bulbs at harvest time. So that's one thing you can do. Now, I know it's supposed to be lucky to plant garlic on, quote, Columbus Day, which may or may not exist anymore. But really, I put mine in as soon as the heat breaks in September.
Okay.
Now, you harvested in June, right?
Well, yeah, everything just fell over by then.
Okay.
So, yes.
That doesn't mean anything.
I didn't get any scapes either.
Well, are you sure you planted hardneck garlic?
I started out with the garlic 5 years ago, hardneck, and I've redone it, done the same thing every year with just taking the old bulb. So
okay. Well, you missed a cue. The fact that, in my mind, you planted late, and then, of course, the weather has been totally, totally unpredictable and all over the place, I'm going to suggest that your garlic was fine, but it hadn't been in the ground long enough. It would be highly unusual for hardneck garlic not to produce scapes, those little seed heads at the top of the main stalk that you cut off to increase the size of the bulb. But you said they laid down. What color were the leaves?
They were getting yellow.
On how much of the plant?
About 50% of it.
Okay, 50% of the stuff that's in the ground or 50% of each individual plant?
Each individual plant. It was pretty uniform.
Okay. Yellow but not brown?
Correct.
That sounds suspicious. Now, we all know that this has been a free gardening season. In other words, if you failed, it wasn't your fault. You know, the weather has just been more monstrous than I can ever remember. Did you leave any bulbs in the ground, or are they all harvested?
They're all harvested now.
Okay. And what part of June?
Early June, like maybe first week.
Oh, man, you're jumping the gun all over the place. You're planting late and you're harvesting early. You and I are in a similar climate. Cherry Hill is just over the bridge from Philadelphia, and I'm about 50 miles from Philadelphia. And I have never even begun to harvest my garlic before the 4th of July.
Well, the only reason I did that is that the stems where the leaves meet the ground,
right,
collapsed. They just collapsed. They were not thickened as they usually have at the same time. Like last year, I didn't harvest until, I think everything started falling over, the scapes and everything started falling over like late June, early July, and I harvested then. But everything was just falling over and just looked sickly, and the stems were just almost like rotted at the
now we're getting somewhere. But the garlic you harvested was okay, but just small?
Well, it looks like a single, not much bigger than a single clove, maybe two or three times the size of a single clove.
Wow. So you're stuck. You're going to have to buy new planting stock.
Yeah. I was wondering if the drought affected it last fall.
Probably. It certainly didn't make it stronger. And then the wet spring gave it the maximum exposure to pathogens. You know, my garden did not dry out for two solid months. You know, there'd be little breaks in the rain, but not enough sun to dry the top of the soil. So again, this is not your fault. And you are going to have to start over. Now, you say you have three beds. How many beds do you grow garlic in?
I grow it in one bed and then rotate it every 3 years.
So you're saying this garlic has been in rotation, quote, in one bed for how many years?
This was the third year for that bed.
It's
going to be rotated this year.
Yep. No, you pressed your luck too much. I have found over the years with climate change that I need to plant my garlic in a different bed every year. And I will tell you, I got scapes. I have big, tall plants that are nice and green, waiting for the bottom leaves to turn brown. But there's a trick I do in the springtime that I want you to try. When you get your plant in garlic, you're going to obviously break it into the best cloves and reserve those for planting. And then you're going to put some baking soda into a bowl of water. You know, I don't know how much. You know, it's just, it's not something that you need to be really accurate about. You know, if you're worried you didn't use enough, use some more. It's cheap. And then soak your cloves, before planting, of course, in that baking soda solution for a solid hour. And then you want to have on hand the cheapest bottle of vodka that your local liquor store can provide. And when you take the cloves out of the baking soda solution, you put them into a bowl filled with pure vodka, which is why I buy the half-gallon size for $9. I mean, it's awful. And then you let that soak for an hour, and then you plant, making sure whatever bed you're planting in hasn't had garlic for quite a while.
Okay.
So the baking soda will act as, one of them acts as an antibiotic, and the other acts as an antipathogen.
Okay.
I'm going to say the baking soda is soil disease. No. I'm going to say the vodka is the soil disease preventer, and the baking soda gets rid of anything that could be already on the clove. Really, that's it. You're going to see a remarkable change. I'm going to tell you that I think you're going to have to rotate every year, whether it's convenient or not. And the nice thing is the neck rot organism that you are fighting dies if it goes a couple of years without a garlic host.
Okay.
So you can go back. But a three-year rotation really means you plant garlic in the same bed only every third year.
Okay.
All right. But again, this was not your fault. Farmers, professional farmers, feel that they have made enough money to make a profit if they get to harvest 55% of their crop. So, you know, if you want perfection all the time, take up woodworking. But gardening is not for the timid, and you have to deal with failure.
Okay.
All right?
I will follow this. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Good luck.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that the time is fast approaching to plant a fall crop of lettuce and other salad greens. They germinate quickly in the warm soil and then are slow to bolt as the evenings get cooler. But don't go perusing your seed catalogs just yet, because we'll be right back to discuss poison ivy prevention and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past three decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a phone call on last week's show sent me deep into the research den. I have come up with what I think is an intriguing prospect for actual poison ivy prevention that combines homeopathy and immunology. You don't want to miss this one. But you won't. It's coming up after some phone calls at 610-694-8100. Emma, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Emma. Where is here for you?
I am in Columbia, Maryland.
Ah, okay. The planned community.
The one, yes.
Yeah. What can I do you for?
So we moved to Columbia and bought a house here about 4 years ago, and we're very lucky. There's tons of garden beds. And when we moved in, we discovered that the big bed in the backyard has chameleon plants. And we moved in the fall, and the next spring we knew it was bad, so we cardboarded over it, and that seems to have just invigorated it. So it came up there, and now it has inched its way into one other bed on the other side of the house, and now it's even gone into our neighbor's yard. So we're just wondering how to control it, to get rid of it and keep it from getting into all the other beds.
Left unchecked, it will come into your house, change the channels on your TV remote, and get a beer from the fridge.
Oh, no.
You are blessed to have one of the most invasive plants in the United States.
Lucky me.
And despite being invasive, this plant was originally sold as an ornamental. I'm sure that yours was deliberately planted.
Mm-hmm.
It's still for sale in many places. And, I mean, it's like signing up to be in a car accident to buy this thing.
It should come with a warning, at the very least.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot of things we got to fix about this business. So basically, here's what's going on. You have a plant that does not spread by seed, either at all or much, but it spreads aggressively via underground rhizomes in the same manner as walking bamboo, running bamboo. So you really can't see the worst part of the plant. Now, can these areas be isolated?
The big bed in the backyard where it started, we've actually tarped over that this year with black plastic because it was just full of aggressives and invasives, so we just kind of wrote it off and we've covered that. Of course, the chameleon plant is coming up at every little tiny hole in the tarp and around the edges, but we can start over. It has moved into a bed that has it has a lot of shrubs and desirable stuff.
Let's stay back with the one you just described, because I'm not sure where you got your information, but to really heat up and destroy plants and their roots, you need clear plastic.
Okay.
The best is 3 mil thick. And what you want to do is not cover over what you don't want to see, but you bludgeon it. You mow it to the ground. And you do this with a bagging mower, even if you have to borrow one. And you trash everything you get. And I mean, I want to see dirt blowing out the back of the mower until you can really see nothing left on top. And you want to do this very early in the spring. But I think in your climate, you have a good chance. What you do is then you saturate this area that you've demolished. And I don't mean water it. I mean absolutely saturate it till it can hold no more liquid. And then you take your clear plastic and you stretch it tight over the area you want to clear and use bricks or something sturdy to hold the edges down. If something does happen to rip the plastic, which should not in one season, see if there's a way you can climb on it and repair it with clear duct tape or something like that.
Okay.
And I hear what you're saying, because the rhizomes will try to come up outside that area.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll be small and weakened. So the best solution is to buy some horticultural vinegar. This is not household pickling vinegar. Vinegar comes out of the barrel at the plant, much more acidic than the ones we use to preserve foods with. So these have been sold as is, as horticultural vinegars. Some of them have had a lot of the fluid drained off to even increase their acidity.
Mm-hmm.
And if you spray and really saturate young plants as they come up, they will die before they can gather energy to feed the root. And the root will eventually dry up. You have to wear safety glasses because you don't want to get vinegar in your eyes, especially high-strength vinegar. I have to say, I've been meaning to mention this for a while. I do see ads on TV for a new organic herbicide called Spruce.
And
I have no idea. I haven't contacted the company to get a sample. I don't know if it works. But if you see it around, you could test it against the vinegar, do half and half. And certainly I would want you to let me know how it worked out. Okay, so that's that area. Let's move.
And that area is right outside the drip line of some very tall pine trees. Will the black or the clear plastic hurt the trees at all?
Well, are you going to cover the roots?
No, it's right outside the drip line. So I think if I just start there and go out, that'll be okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No problem. Yeah, be consistent, really follow those directions, you know, be ready with that spray. It's going to take you a whole summer. The next summer, you may see the plant struggling to come back, and that's when you double down. That's when you do the mowing, a fresh sheet of plastic, saturated soil, and then you should be done. Because the rhizomes need the energy of living plant material above ground to survive. Now, before you mentioned drip lines, and this is a plant that loves moist areas.
Mm-hmm.
Does the area drain poorly? Is it often wet?
No, it's actually relatively dry because it's on a slope, so all the water runs away from that area.
Okay, good.
So it's pretty dry.
Yeah, that increases your chances of success. So let's move on quick. Where's the
next?
We've
got another bed connected by a hedge, so it's run under the hedge and into this other bed. And that bed is, it's got a lot of youngish natives and shrubs.
So again, what you would want to do the whole, it's called a stale seed bed, the mowing to the ground, to dirt, saturating the soil, laying down 3 mil clear plastic, and making sure the edges are held down tight. And in this case, you would do it on both sides of the shrub. Get rid of them as best you can. Then you're going to have to, it's hard to imagine the way it interacts with the shrub, but you're either going to have to get in there and try to do some damage, or if you want to just be done, I'm sure you're going to transplant your natives and things that you've got going there, right?
Yep.
How big and old is the hedge?
It's probably 20 feet long. It's forsythia, so it's unruly.
Oh, God, that's not a hedge.
It's an inherited hedge.
That's another invasive plant.
I'm happy to get rid of that, too.
Well, you're going to have a lot of trouble Forsythia also travels underground, and it must be causing you problems already because those vines are powerful. They reach up and grab things and tear down sheds and arbors and pull trees to the ground.
It eats my yard by about 3 feet every year.
Yeah. You've inherited a lot of really invasive plants.
Mm-hmm.
So the Forsythia, it's a rope and dope. You're going to keep cutting it off at the ground. It won't mm-hmm. seem to harm the plant. But once it's severed from the soil, all that above ground growth is going to brown out and die. And you can let it go until late summer, early winter, and then pull it out when it will be
okay.
easier to remove. And then you just got to do that over and over again. You got to mow that area relentlessly. Again, always trashing the plant material you collect. And after a couple of years, with the assistance of the vinegar for spot treatments, you should get an upper hand on it. But you got two tough battles on your hand, Em.
I hear you.
All right, is that good enough for now?
Yeah, I'm ready. I got my work cut out for me.
Yeah, unfortunately, a chameleon plant is known to be highly resistant to chemical herbicides, so that's not even an option. You'd just poison your land and not harm the plant. So this is going to be physical. And, you know, depending on your resources and your own abilities, you might want to try to hire a reputable landscaper to help you with some of this, as long as they're willing to do what I said.
Okay. I mean, the smell alone makes me want to pass it off to someone else. So
well,
it's an option.
Yeah. It's tough. I can't kid you. But keep up with it, and good luck. I'm sorry I didn't have better news for you.
No, I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Every once in a while, we get a really interesting email or phone call from a listener who can't be available during our taping session. So we're getting in the habit now picking out the best of those calls and answering them after the fact without any interaction. So I'll do my best. And here comes one.
My name is Rose and I live in the Ozarks here in Missouri. And a comment is about the wireless deer detractor. We're right in the middle of deer country here. And there is a law in Missouri that you cannot put a deer attractant anywhere on your property. It's also my deer, you have to go through all sorts of hideous things like tangling thorn-covered briars, barbed wire fences, and you name it. And I don't think that a poke in their nose would make that much difference to them. I don't know. I haven't tried it, but what I use is an animal stopper. And essentially, it smells like dead meat. So I thought that might help. Love your show. Bye.
Well, I can understand the law because hunters will often try to lure deer to a specific area where they have a tree stand set up. And I believe that is illegal in many states. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, it's just unfair. You're not really hunting. You're like shooting metal ducks at a carnival or something. What you're referring to is called the wireless deer fence. And again, you look it up online, wireless deer fence. You get three stakes with electrodes on the top and scent pellets that you use to attract the deer to the electrodes on the top. They get a mild shock and run away. Now, I have to tell you, I mean, you're not piling up a huge amount of corn in a field and then picking them off. So I don't think the law was meant for this, but I think it's worthwhile. the animal repellent you mentioned is probably made from rotten eggs, essentially. And it is very effective at keeping deer and other herbivores away. But as you know, you have to reapply it after rains. It loses its effectiveness. So my solution is the motion-activated sprinkler. I mean, you have a long season there. You could have this thing hooked up for all the growing season before you get a freeze. And it's very simple. I mean, you'll find a lot of them online, motion-activated sprinkler. It senses, it has a motion activator in the head of this device. And then you can either have a short stake that puts it in the ground, or I went for a big tripod that holds it above everything because it's much more effective. And when the motion detector detects something as big as a deer, for God's sake, it shoots a couple of cups of cold water at them and they run away. I use both. I have a motion-activated sprinkler to protect my garden, but I have hostas, beds of hostas, all throughout the rest of my property, and the last 2 years, the deer have eaten them before they can flower. So this year I went ballistic, took all of the wireless deer fence stakes I had, which was a dozen, made sure there were fresh batteries in them, made sure they had fresh attractor pellets, and surrounded the hostas, which is deer's favorite food, with them. And so far, I shouldn't be saying this, should I? I should wait until the flowers are done. But so far, the stalks of the hostas are untouched, and I see the purple flowers beginning to emerge. So you're welcome to keep using your repellent. There's no law against using the motion-activated sprinkler. Okay? Good luck to you. Well, it's time for me to announce to first-time garlic growers that it is time to get your planting stock in hand. Remember that every single clove you plant into rich, well-drained soil will produce a full head of fabulous garlic cloves right around this time next year. But don't you go choosing hard neck or soft neck just yet, because we'll be right back with a fascinating possibility about poison ivy and more of your fascinating phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. What can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will reveal what I have learned about the possibility of poison ivy prevention. Not after the fact, but preventing the rash from ever occurring. It's an amazing question of the week, if I do say so myself. And we'll get to it right after another of your phone calls at 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Every once in a while, we have a listener write in who has a great question, but they're not available to be on the show. So we listen to their voicemail, and then we answer it like this.
This is Nancy calling from Maple Glen. I had sent Mike a couple pictures of my sad fig tree, that's in my backyard here in Maple Glen. It's about 8 years old, maybe nine, always had nice leaves and nice growth, and about 4 years ago we started getting some fruit. Well, this year it looks very sad. I've got a lot of some new growth on the bottom and some a little bit of green leaves here and there on the branches. So I did send you a picture. I wasn't sure if you could guess what's bothering it, if I need to treat it in some way, or if I need to cut back the branches that are not, don't have any leaves on them. If you could just point me in the right direction. We really love the tree and we'd like to give it a little boost and help it get back to good health. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Have a wonderful day.
All right, Nancy. The picture tells a thousand stories. Yes, I know exactly what's going on. The weather has been so unpredictable with climate change and everything like that. I am surprised that your tree looks, well, it's hard to say. It's a stump with little stuff growing out of it. And there shouldn't be a stump there, because what I'm thinking is you failed to protect it over winter. And this is not a Mediterranean climate in your suburb of Philadelphia. And most fig trees really need to be protected. One of the easiest ways to do it is to wrap Remay around the fig at the end of the growing season and prevent it, you know, give it a little boost from freezing hard. Now, when a fig does freeze hard and is not going to, quote, make it through the winter, it appears to die completely. But what happens is the roots are invulnerable and they will sprout up the following spring. But again, figs are a Mediterranean fruit. They need a long time to produce. And what happens is that new growth really reestablishes the tree's biomass. And by the end of the season, you should now have a nice fig tree, but probably no figs because there just wasn't enough happening. It didn't get enough biomass over the summer. Now, yours is weird. I've never seen one like this where there is a big stump. And then you've got what I would call suckers coming out of the ground. Then some aerial branches. So here's your choices. I would cut off those suckers laying on the ground. They're not going to do you any good. And hopefully there's enough above ground growth that this summer it will sprout leaves and it will grow. And then at the end of the season, you will wrap it. Now, if you go online, you'll find a million different directions for wrapping fig trees. And most of them are good. Just don't use clear plastic. Don't use plastic of any kind. Floating row cover is my favorite, but you can just drape a sheer curtain over top of it and tie it at the bottom. It doesn't need a lot of help, but yours especially is in a totally unprotected area. It's out in the open by itself. Its only companion seems to be a stepladder and a cat. So what I would do, although this is probably going to hurt you, I would cut it off all the way at the base. And just to get rid of the weird proportions, I would cut it all the way at the base. It will regrow this season. And then you wrap up that regrowth and make sure you protect it over winter. And the following spring, when you unwrap the tree, it should already be growing. And with a little bit of biomass from this year, and then, you know, a full season of growing whatever it had this year, you may even get figs. But definitely, if you just remember to protect the tree over winter, you'll definitely get figs by year number two or three, and you'll get more of them than you can even imagine. The figs just don't have enough time to ripen up on a tree that was not protected over winter. So easy peasy. You choose whichever way you want to go, but there's nothing wrong with the tree. It's just not being protected. All right, as promised, a very special question of the week. Can you prevent a poison ivy reaction? On last week's show, Stephen from Missouri brought up a topic that absolutely floored me. He was responding to a spate of recent callers concerning poison oak, poison ivy, and oriental bittersweet, which I had only learned also contained the highly allergenic and rash-producing urushiol, the compound that activates the allergic response. By the way, I really wanted to try pronouncing that word correctly for a change and studied five different pronunciation websites before I was confident that I was at least getting close to it. In my behalf, it was rated very difficult to pronounce on at least two of those sites. So add in my dyslexia, and I'm happy to at least come close. And it's much better than the clumsy way I used to say it. By the way, it is spelled U-R-U-S-H-I-O-L, which also isn't a lot of help. Anyway, Stephen recounted that he had been a lineman for what was then the Bell Telephone Company, which required him to climb telephone poles in the South, many of which were covered with poison ivy, making it treacherous work. But Stephen recounted that the company had supplied its linemen with something he recalled being named immune ivy. It was a liquid that you mixed with water and took on a regular basis that would eventually protect you from the deaded urushiol. And it did. He reported that while taking this liquid, he was able to climb poison ivy-covered poles without a reaction. This was years ago, and he wondered if it was still around. Well, so did I. And when I got home, I started a deep search looking for it. As did Steve, and I came up empty. So I began searching around it, looking for a connection. Luckily, my background as a medical writer helped a lot. To me, taking a liquid over a long period of time to prevent a reaction could mean two things. One, the liquid was acting like allergy injections, where you are exposed to small amounts of the subject react to, with the dosage increasing over time until your body no longer recognizes the allergen as a threat. Countless studies conducted over many decades have shown it to be very effective, especially against seasonal pollens and house dust. The other possibility was homeopathy, a discipline first practiced by a Dr. Samuel Hahnemann, a highly respected German physician who established the first homeopathic hospital, located in Philadelphia, in 1848, where it remained a working and teaching hospital, although no longer homeopathic, until it was acquired by a private equity firm in 2018, who closed it down a year later. Homeopathy operates much like those allergy shots. Simply put, homeopathic cures involve taking a single drop of a substance deemed responsible for a condition or a reaction, placing it in a gallon of clean water, and then shaking that gallon in a specifically designed manner. Then a drop of that water goes through the same process, continuing the dilutions until science can detect none of the active ingredient. To quote Hahnemann, The vigorous shaking causes the substance to leave behind a spirit-like essence that, although no longer perceptible to the senses, is nevertheless remembered by the water and thus retains its healing properties. Many homeopathic medicines go through dozens of dilutions, but some only go through two or three. And research has shown that these less aggressive dilutions still contain small amounts of the original substance, enough perhaps to mimic those allergy shots. Which brings me to oral ivy, a homeopathic remedy designed to prevent poison ivy reactions that I found at a forestry supply website. And I quote, "This homeopathic treatment is formulated to relieve the symptoms of contact dermatitis associated with poison ivy, oak, and sumac. The easy-to-take liquid helps to relieve itching, red or burning rashes, oozing or crusting blisters, swelling, and skin irritation. Take 10 drops, which is 0.2 milliliters, in 2 ounces of water every 2 hours as needed. Oral ivy," they continue, "is an over-the-counter homeopathic medicine extracted with alcohol from poison ivy leaves, Roustox. The manufacturing process is in accordance with the principles of homeopathy as set forth in the Homeopathic Pharmacopoeia of the United States, the acknowledged authority on homeopathic medicines." Referring to a recent oncology study, the National Library of Medicine notes that, quote, "Some natural health products are sold as homeopathic agents, despite the fact that they do contain detectable levels of pharmacologically active agents. A 2 or 3 times dilution in homeopathic terms could be pharmacologically active. For example, Tramiel, an anti-inflammatory, is a complex mixture of natural health products termed homeopathic, but mainly diluted only 2 or 3 times, and a randomized controlled study found it to improve chemotherapy-induced mucosis. Modern U.S. patents for similar projects go back to at least 2016. The directions for oral ivy specify 10 drops and 2 ounces of water every 2 hours, and there is approximately 0.02 milliliter of Roustox in every full drop of oral ivy homeopathic solution. Now, that sure sounds pharmacologically active to me. Now, I'm not recommending this specific product or any of the similar ones out there, but those with severe allergy to poison ivy might want to research this further, because it sure sounds like immunology meets homeopathy to me. Well, that sure was some hopefully helpful information about poison ivy prevention, now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hide my homeopathics if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. And follow the prompts to reach You Bet Your Garden. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter how you contact us, I'm begging you. I'm on my knees. No, I'm not on my knees because I need help getting up. But please include your location and visit our Facebook page. where we continually post new photos of the stuff that looks good in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week, and links to our priceless podcasts. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he found out that he could not jump over a tall building in a single bound. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziproth. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll still be keeping an eye on my garlic so I can harvest each bulb at just the right stage, which is when the bottom third of the plants have turned brown, because we pick no garlic before it's time. But I'll stop looking at my garlic long enough to see you again next week.